Order to the Stanislaus County Board of Supervisors meeting. Today's December 4th, 2012. The time is 9 o'clock a.m. Everybody please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We have a very exciting presentation this morning. We are going to do the Red Ribbon Week 2012 Best Decorated School Contest, the awards. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. My name is Elizabeth, and I am here. We have somebody honoring us today. Mr. Tom Chagnon is here with us, our superintendent of schools. And I'm also here with my colleagues Charmaine Monti and Doris Clark. Doris will be taking pictures. We would like to thank you right now for giving us the opportunity to be here and to recognize some very, very deserving schools. They participated in our Red Ribbon Week Best Decorated, Best Spirited Schools contest, and these are the winning schools. And so they did a great job throughout Stanislaus County. These schools participate annually. They do assemblies. They bring drug dogs on campus. They do a lot of awareness about the dangers of drug use. And so we just really wanted to thank them all for being here and spending this morning with us. So we will get started. And, okay, so we want to thank everyone again. And each of the school sites are going to receive a plaque and also a certificate from the Stanislaus County Office of Education. So we'll go ahead and get started with the elementary division. Okay, so elementary, we actually had a lot of schools. We had over 30 schools participate in this contest this year, so it was extremely, extremely hard for us to decide who the winning schools were. We have honorable mentions in every category, so we have elementary, middle school, and high school categories. Our honorable mention for our elementary school site is Osborne Elementary School. And, yes. We're not sure if anybody from Osborne is here. Nope. Okay, third place, California Avenue. Oh, all right. Thank you. Oh, good picture. Okay, so our third place for elementary was California Avenue School. Do you guys want to come up? Thank you. Our second place winner for elementary category is Whitehead Elementary School. Thank you. And our first place winner for our elementary category is Walnut Elementary School. Thank you. All right, so now we move on to the middle school junior high division, and our honorable mention this year is Hanshaw Junior High. In third place, we have Glick Middle School. Second place is Waterford Junior High. Come on up. And first place, we'd like to invite up Roosevelt Junior High School. All right, our last category is the high school winners, and our honorable mention this year was Ceres High School. And I don't think anyone was able to attend, so we'll move right along. We have third place, Houston High School, who they were also not able to attend, but we'll give them a round of applause. Second place, we'd like to invite up Waterford High School. And our first place winners for the high school division is Elliott Alternative Education. Come on up. And Elliott, they had, instead of a red ribbon week, they had a purple ribbon week. And so their plaque is purple, and so is their certificate. Once again, thank you very much. We really appreciate being here today.
Well, thank you very much for being here, and congratulations to all the schools for your awards, and a thank you to our superintendent of schools, Tom Chenyon. Thank you for coming down this morning. Very good. At this point, do you want the schools to meet out front? Okay. Thank you very much. Good job, everybody. We're going to wait just a minute before we proceed here.
Sure you can.
Okay, we're going to proceed with item 3 on our agenda, which is public comment period. This is time on the agenda when anybody can address this Board of Supervisors on any item within our purview. We have a 5-minute time limit on the speakers. I have 3 specific requests to speak. We'll start there. John Mataka, Grayson Neighborhood Council. Okay, then we'll move to Betsy.
Good morning, Chairman O'Brien and members of the Board of Supervisors. I appreciate the opportunity. My name is Betsy Reif-Snyder. I'm the Environmental Justice Coordinator for Catholic Charities in the Stockton Diocese, which includes Stanislaus County. And we are a part, along with a few other representatives in the audience, of a local coalition that's working for clean air in our area and valley-wide. We're here today to seek your input and guidance. We're planning to meet with the San Joaquin Air District as well, but it's our belief that the Air District could benefit and might appreciate input from the local supervisors throughout our valley. And so that's why we're here today. And specifically, we wanted to talk about emergency air alerts as one of the issues that we would like to bring input to our San Joaquin Air District. And I do have, as you can see up there, some slides, and I have timed it for under 5 minutes. You may know that researchers at the Central Valley Health Policy Institute and UC San Francisco found that in the 3 days immediately following high levels of wintertime particulate pollution, that young people were 49% more likely to be admitted to emergency rooms for asthma and 67% more likely to be admitted to hospitals. Now, after high levels of summertime ozone pollution, young people were 69% more likely to be admitted to an emergency room for asthma. And unfortunately, it appears that dangerous levels of air pollution will be with us for a while longer. Attainment of our federal health standard, as you can see the line right there, is expected no earlier than 2023, and our already outdated standards for particulate matter won't be achieved until 2019 at best. So all of this brings us to our quick request today. Public health warnings. We need them, and we need them now. The Valley Air Board issues emergency health warnings when either smoky or dusty conditions are bad or when summertime ozone levels are, quote, extremely dangerous. This means that there's no warning system when the health protective levels for fine particulate matter or ozone pollution have been surpassed. For example, here you can see the hourly readings for Central Fresno of July 12th of this year. This was officially an orange flag, that's the level 3 level for that day. But as you can see, from noon until 8 p.m. that night, we had 3 hours at the orange level, 3 in the red, and then 4 in the extremely dangerous purple level. This was perhaps the worst day anywhere in the valley last year. This past year. And right now, our emergency air alerts for ozone are only issued if the 1 hour ozone peak is going to hit that high bar of 125 parts per billion, which is this level, that top purple line. We're well into the purple level by then. Federal health standard for ozone is the orange level, that lower level. Anytime we're above this standard, our health is at risk, and emergency air alerts should be issued anytime our air pollution passes the federal level. This is when our kids are 69% more likely to be admitted to emergency rooms due to asthma attacks. Now, similarly, I'd like to show you the current level at which emergency warnings are issued for high levels of fine particulate matter, but I can't because currently there aren't any. So we believe quite strongly that there should be, and that they should be issued when fine particulate reaches the dangerous orange level. This is the level when, due to asthma attacks, young people are 49% more likely to be admitted to emergency rooms and 67% more likely to be admitted to hospitals. So in closing, here is the ozone level you can see on the far right there at which our Valley Air Board currently issues the public health warnings. And again, there is currently no level for particulate matter. Here is the level for both that we believe emergency air alerts should be issued, and an effective emergency air alert system throughout the valley will help protect all of our health. And so we have submitted a request to the Air District, and we assume that early next year we will be talking about this with them. But we thought it was important for all local officials to have an opportunity for input, too, to ask your own questions. So my last slide there, health experts estimated that 60% of Valley residents fall into the category of sensitive groups. These include everyone under the age of 18, over the age of 65, people with heart or lung conditions, and people who work outside or do heavy exercise. Again, we believe that when 6 out of every 10 people are at risk, an emergency clearly exists, and that the emergency air alerts are needed. So we would encourage and welcome you to stand for clean air in the San Joaquin Valley. And we thank you so much for your time, and we'd appreciate any input.
Very good. Thank you. All right, John Mataka.
Good Good morning, Board.
Good morning.
My name is John Mataka. I'm the president of the Grayson Neighborhood Council. I'm here today to support the previous speaker's presentation and asking the county to ask the Air Board and to consider starting these emergency alerts earlier. Now, you know from our experience before this board how our community has suffered as a result of pollution, from the 1999 tire fire to the incinerator, garbage incinerator, the only one up north here in our community, to the I-5 pollution of the diesel trucks, pesticides and everything else. So we have a long history. Wesley is one of the highest areas in our county for asthma issues with the children. So we really feel that this is something that is key. We know that young people and elderly people are the most affected by these bad air days. Those are the two parts of our pollution that everybody says they care the most about: children and seniors. You find it hard to say somebody that they don't care about those two populations. Everybody in the middle, well, they can have at it. But seniors and children are key. Well, those are the ones that are affected most by these bad air days. From my perspective, I think it's key. I don't think we're talking about a big money issue here. We already give the alerts. All we're asking is that they, you know, be given earlier. It's a form of prevention. We do prevention in drug and alcohol. We work with young people earlier to make them aware of what the dangers are considering drug and alcohol. We do it with gang prevention. So it's time to do it with our air. And so I would strongly encourage this board to consider having some discussion and to contact Betty and Stand Up for Clean Air and the rest of us about having this discussion, to starting those earlier. And let's do some prevention, because the bottom line is, in our community, when people have respiratory problems, a lot of folks don't have insurance. And it becomes a budget item when they have to go to the emergency room for an asthma attack, you know, versus, you know, maybe knowing that it's a good day to stay inside and maybe not having to go. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Marcella Mars Alatori, Kings County. Good morning.
Good morning. Maricela Mares Alatorre with People for Clean Air and Water of Kettleman City, and with Green Action for Health and Environmental Justice, which does organizing in communities here in San Jose County, including Wesley. And I'm very, very happy to be before you after driving 3 hours through the fog. I'm very happy to be here addressing you, because this is a very important issue. I'm here supporting Betsy's presentation. And as a member of the Stand for Clean Air Coalition, it's very important to get these alerts out as early as possible. Being from Kettleman City, which has seen so many environmental issues in our town, a lot of the things similar to what Mr. Mataka mentioned, the pesticides in the field, the diesel pollution from I-5, we have the largest toxic waste dump west of the Mississippi. We need to let people know so that they can protect themselves, because there are so many people out there that are working outside in the fields, farm workers, they don't have insurance, and as John said, that becomes a problem for all of us when people are going to the emergency rooms because they have these breathing issues. And I think it's very important to have this dialogue within the counties. We're all members of one air district. What happens up in Stockton affects us down in Kettleman City, affects us up in down in Arvin. So it's very important that all our local administrators have the opportunity to give input and to put this out to the public, so that people are aware that while we have these alerts available, if we could have them even earlier, we're doing even more to protect seniors, children, and anyone that breathes, which is all of us. So I thank you for the opportunity to address you, and I really hope that you consider it.
Great. Thank you. Anybody else wish to address this board under public comment? Seeing none, I'll have a couple comments back. Thank you all for coming down today. It's good at any time that we can talk about air pollution. A couple of things that, I mean, I am the chairman of the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District this year, only one more meeting. And so I know a little bit about what this request is, and I think it's important that we give credit to the RAN network, the RAAN network. And what's happened is, as technology has advanced, the Air District now can give hourly updates and warnings rather than a forecast for a day. That example that was shown on the screen, I think the request would be to put up a purple flag, but that was for 4 hours of the day, when it could scare the public to think that the entire day is purple. And so what we've come up with is a way to notify the public of hourly updates of exactly where the air pollution levels are. Now, the hard part, and I think they will all tell you that the hard part has been getting better public awareness of that. The flag system that you see at schools has been great, but we've kind of have surpassed that with technology now that we have more readily available information at any given time. You know, just like a forecaster for the weather, you know, they're kind of right, but they're not usually right on. And so we're trying to figure out a way to get this hourly information out to the public better. It's available now on email and text messages, and there will be a iPhone app launched today, actually, that can get better information out to the public. So those are good things. The air alert system that you saw the logo on the screen, we devised that basically around the $29 million fine that the Air Pollution District has to pass on to its people. And that's for the ozone, which is usually summertime and very hot temperatures. The thought process behind that was we are fining our residents $29 million a year. We better tell them how they can not get that fine. And that's what the air alert system came out of, saying, you know, hey, we are projecting that this is going to be a bad air day, and you can do something to prevent that $29 million fine from coming to you. As far as PM 2.5 particulate matter wintertime, the number one source of PM 2.5 actually comes from houses. It is wood burning. And just a reminder out there for everybody, check before you burn, before you light that fireplace from November through February, check before you burn. Any comments from my colleagues? Not.
I have one comment. At CSAC this last week in one of the committees, Cal EPA was there, and they're doing a health assessment by zip code. And it was very interesting because they take a lot of these factors into account. Now, you guys are probably more familiar with this than I am, but it was very interesting that going to break it down by zip code should be available in the spring. They're going out for comment now. They gave us the principles of the argument, looking at heart disease, looking at PM 2.5 levels. I'm trying to think what all the, but there's a bunch of factors, pesticide use and some other things. And it was very interesting. It is going to be a guide. It's not going to be anything mandatory, but it will be, give us some principles to work by county. We know air quality is worse in the Southern Valley than it is in the Northern Valley, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing our part. So,
very good. Okay, move on to consent calendar. Consent calendar consists of items on the agenda marked with an asterisk. Does any Board of Supervisors wish any item pulled from consent calendar for a separate vote or separate discussion? Anybody in the audience wish to comment on any consent calendar item? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the Board.
Make a motion to approve.
Motion by Withrow. Second by Monteith. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That item passes 5-0. Okay, move on. Item A6. Approval to accept the clerk recorder certified statement of the results of the presidential general election held Tuesday, November 6, 2012, and declare the results. And here is our clerk recorder.
Good morning.
Voters, Lee Lungergan.
Good morning, Chairman O'Brien, CEO Nino, County Council Doring, and members of the Board of Supervisors. I'm very happy to be here today to give you a report on the presidential election from November 6, 2012. The presidential election results have been brought before this board. As the County Clerk Recorder and Registrar of Voters, it is the duty and job of myself and my office to have certification of the numbers of this election. Normally it is the job of the board to declare winners. However, there are no county items on this agenda this time. for the board to really declare, so you're basically just accepting it. The two declarations are on behalf of local and the state of California. Those are the items that we're on this time. I do have some information to give you, and that is this is the largest election and provisionals we have had in the history of Stanislaus County. I brought up some of the historical information for you. It's also the most vote-by-mails we have ever received. We received 102,238 vote-by-mails for a total of 107,102 being received by mail. And what that means is not only people who voted by mail automatically, because that's what they were automatically wanting to do, it's also people who were voting because they were in an all-mail district. That's a district of less than 250 voters, and those individuals automatically vote by mail. They do not have a polling site. We had 167 polling sites for a 67.39% turnout in this election. The last time we had an election of that number was in 2004, when it was 67.72%, pretty close. The ones I have before and after that date was the 2008. That was the largest one we've had, 70%, almost 71% there. In 2000, 64%. In 1996, 64%. So our numbers are actually increasing. And with that increase and all of the changes that have been made in Sacramento, there it's taking longer and longer to certify the vote. And why is that? Basically, individuals who come to vote used to come to the polling site to vote. When they voted, that was it. Their vote was complete at that point in time. Now they're voting by mail, and they're turning in their vote by mail from the day we mail it out, 29 days in advance of the election is the soonest we can mail it, up until 8 o'clock on election night. And people are actually jumping in the doors of polling sites and becoming provisional voters and becoming vote-by-mail voters at that point in time. And I'll explain that in just a second, how that works. So basically, what we're looking at is we're looking at an increase in items that are taking place after Election Day. So up to Election Day, and I do have a figure here for you. I can find it in all of the papers I brought. There were more and more individuals that were bringing in paperwork and their vote by mails up to the last minute. So we received, on the last day possible, 24,130 vote by mails on the very last day. That's 24,000 additional. In increasing in the last 4 to 5 days up until that day, we had to work all of those ballots. We also had a bumper crop, I guess we'll call it, of provisionals, 11,353. Of those 11,353, 9,459 of them were able to be counted. 1,894 of them were not able to be counted. The primary reason we couldn't count a provisional ballot, the person wasn't registered to vote here in Stanislaus County. The second primary reason, the individual didn't fill out the document. And the third and final reason, and there's some others in between there, but the most, was their signatures did not match. They only matched on a very small percentage, very small percentage. So we're looking basically at individuals who are voting differently. They are voting in ways they haven't voted in the past, and it is increasing the workload that takes place after the election. In the 12 days after the election, and that's the 12 work days, it was actually, we completed this on the 22nd day of the 28 days we're allowed. Of those 12 days, we had a total of 75 observers in our office. The highest amount was 24 in one day. 1 to 2 people standing behind each of our staff members as they worked the provisional ballots in the computer. We had roughly 4,150 in that range of affidavits, registers, people registering on the last day possible. It took us up until Election Day to get all of that inputted. At the same day, people are asking for information about where their polling sites are, asking for information about can they get an additional ballot. People can vote up to three ballots, so they can spoil two, they can make mistakes on two, and use up to a third. And some people actually sent them in and asked for a third ballot. So those were some of the things that took place. I have lots of other numbers here to tell you about, but basically I'm going to let you ask any questions you might want at this time.
Questions for Supervisor DeMartini?
That was the electing observer for the board. Now, before I even get started, I want to say that everything was run very efficiently and properly, and I saw nothing of any concern to me. But I am curious about the provisional ballots, because 4 years ago we had 700 provisional ballots, more or less, and this year we had 11,000. And do you give us any idea why it was so many?
Well, in the state of California, there are close to 1 million provisional ballots. It's the most the state has ever had. So it's not just our county alone. This is happening on a wider basis throughout California. I think that there's a few reasons that can be brought forth. We do not know why someone actually walks in and votes provisionally. They don't tell us. They don't say, I'm here because of, they don't have to give a reason. They just come to vote. And we allow every single person who comes to a voting location the ability to vote, and they vote what's called provisionally. The ballot is the same ballot that anyone else votes. They put it in a separate envelope, a pink envelope. That pink envelope allows us to come back and research it back at our office, where we have the ability to look on the state website to see if that is a registered voter somewhere else, where we have the ability to look through our voter records, where we have ability to see if they have already voted by mail. Did they vote at a different polling site? You know, did they vote at a different county? We can check all of those things before we can count that ballot. And often, the primary reason that people are voting provisionally, and I'm not exactly sure where this came from, but they came into the polling site, they were supposed to be a vote-by-mail voter. They came in, they did not have their vote-by-mail ballot, and they want to vote. Because I don't have the ballot I was sent to vote, we put it in a provisional mode, which allows us to check it and make sure that they didn't mail that in and get to vote twice. So it is designed to allow as many voters as possible to vote without allowing any voters to vote twice. So that's the purpose of it. I think we have seen in the last 4 years a number of people moving. Unfortunately, we had a number of people calling on Election Day indicating, were they registered? were they registered at the right address, et cetera? And I think a number of people just went out and voted at wherever they could vote. They may have, supposed to have a vote-by-mail ballot, but if they weren't there to get it at their old address, they came in without it. So we found a very small number of individuals who had actually voted by mail and went out and voted provisionally. That is amongst the numbers we catch. If we believe it is in the fraudulent level, we will send that to the Secretary of State for them to look into further. But if we believe it is a mistake on the part of the voter, then we don't.
Yeah, I just got a little bit more because I'm more curious about these provisional ballots. What impact did that have on this online registration that the state did for the first time this year?
Well, the state allowed first-time online registration. They only did it a few weeks before the election. So the last day to register was the 22nd of October, 15 days prior to Election Day. Because of that date, we saw primarily 18 to 20-year-old voters or 25-year-old voters in that range. Were the ones who were registering in that manner. So they were very young. When they registered up until their 30s, say, and the last time they went and registered was, or they went to their DMV and filled out the signature item at DMV, might have been when they were 16, 18. If it was back in that time, that was what was automatically imprinted on the vote by mail, or excuse me, the online voter registration. So what we're doing is we have absolutely no writing by the voter, nothing. Only something electronic with a signature that might have been 10 years old when they were 16 or 18 years old. And those were problematic. And we were attempting our very best to update those. We have thousands, literally, to send out to people to get an update on their registration. I think they're going to be surprised when they registered to do it online and think it's all done, and they get something from us in the mail that says, please register again so we can get a current signature of you. So I think that had a lot to do with it, the fact that we were inputting those up until Election Day. We got over 4,000 of those on the very last day you could do it. Huge, huge amounts. These are numbers that are historically unique.
And if the signatures didn't match under motor vehicle license, did you throw it out? Or
if a person registers with a regular handwritten voter registration, we open that up, we scan the whole thing, we open it up, we look at all aspects of it. Is the printing the same? Did they sign it someplace else on the document? We look at every way we can possibly get that voter the credit to having voted. But if all we have is an electronic image with the only signature on it, something from the DMV that doesn't match what we have in front of us, we can't go any further than that. And those turned out to be not counted.
And
so their vote did not count if that was the case.
And on the online registration, if a required field was not filled out, what did you do with that ballot?
You know, that's interesting you should bring that up, because there is going to be a meeting this Friday with the Secretary of State, and our IT staff and our management from elections is going to be at that. To tell them, one of the major problems we found by rushing something through, the Secretary of State did not check with us first. They did not partner with us to see if what our registration required as opposed to what they put together online, so that that wasn't a match, number one. So every one of these electronic registrations that we received, we had to actually print it out, scan it back into our equipment, and hand type it. I mean, this wasn't something that automatically went in. That's number one. Number two, and I think this was really surprising to us, was that there were several groups that allowed people to register on their sites. They then implemented that registration by going behind the front page of the Secretary of State. And so the items on the Secretary of State that they would not accept were accepted by these other firms, since they went beneath that front stopping page. We got things with no signatures, we got things with no addresses, no names, all kinds of things came through. So the Secretary of State was able to stop that, but not up until the very last minute, so there's a number of those items out there as well. But it was a rush-through item, so that's what happens when you, move very quickly in government on electronics.
I just have one last question there, because I didn't observe the counting of the military ballots there. Was everything
The military ballots worked very well. The military has been for several years now allowed to vote and send their vote in using a fax machine. And we have a specialized fax machine just for military voters. It's locked in our vault. One person has access to it, so we keep it as secret as possible. However, they do have to waive their right to secrecy to vote that way, but they can get their votes in last minute, and if they're out in the field, it doesn't stop them from voting, and they voted in very high numbers this time. So we're very pleased to see our military turnout.
Okay. Supervisor Monteith?
What was the internet registration? But basically, those that did not have driver's license, how in the world do you verify those in 2 weeks? You don't have an opportunity to do that. Do you?
Well, if you don't have a driver's license and you're trying to register online, that's a problem. You can't get a signature. So those are then stopped for signature. And
okay.
We would have to, like, contact.
Were they able to vote, or they weren't able to vote?
Well, it depends on if we got them contacted and we got signatures for them.
Okay, but...
Or some were and some weren't.
So yes and no?
Yes and no.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments?
One thing I do want to bring up, and that is the future. And this is something that we'll have to be speaking to the board about. Same-day registration has just passed in California. The only reason it wasn't something we actually experienced this time was because it won't be implemented until the statewide system is installed. The Help America Vote Act of 2000 required all states to have a statewide system so that you could tell who was registered within the entire state. So, for example, if someone registered in Merced County and San Joaquin County and Stanislaus County, you would be able to tell that they were all registered, and it would stop the registrations, and only the most recent registration would count. Until that is completely smoothed out and completed, I'm not using the high technical terms, I'm sure my staff is dying right now, it's the right terms you're supposed to use for the IT, but until that is completed, they could not do same-day registration, because you're registering, and it has to be able to go through every other county and make sure that that person's not registered anyplace else in real time. However, that is anticipated to be up and running by the next gubernatorial election, which means that people will be able to come in instead of the stop date 15 days in advance. They will be able to register all the way up until election day in our office at the same point in time that we are trying to make sure that the vote is counted. And I will tell you right now that this will impact how quickly we can work the vote by mails, because we're not going to be able to accomplish that and get those persons typed in and all of their information updated at the same time we're working the huge numbers of vote by mails we're receiving. So that's the future.
Very good. Any other questions or comments? Any questions or comments from public members, audience today? Seeing none, I'll bring it back for this board to accept these results.
Motion to approve.
Second.
Motion and second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passes 5-0. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll move to item B7, approval to finalize and submit a proposal to the State of California to enter into a partnership to operate a local health benefit exchange call center site in Stanislaus County.
Good morning. I want to thank you for hearing us again. We may be back a third time, but we'll see how that goes. First of all, I want to introduce and thank a lot of people who have put a lot of work into this proposal. Right here to my left is Christy Santos, who's our lead person. She's our assistant director for Stanworks. Next to her is Patrice Dietrich, who's our assistant director for fiscal and operations in our department. And then Kim Martinez, who is our PowerPoint whiz, who you've seen many times bring us PowerPoints to the board. I also want to thank the CEO's office and many of the people within the CEO office that have helped us with this, everyone from county council to the analysts to the management consultants, Monica and Patty, and many of the people there who have helped with this proposal. So there's a lot of people behind this, and we're going to share with you what we've got so far today. And I am Chris Applegate. I'm the Director of Community Services Agencies for 3 more days. So we're here to talk to you about our Health Benefit Exchange Call Center proposal. And as we shared with you a few weeks ago, this is an opportunity to put in a proposal to the State of California, to the Health Benefit Exchange Board, who are developing a platform to do call centers within the state. What we're proposing is to develop a hybrid call center model in which a county can fulfill all the functions of a call center in order to offer uninsured Californians the opportunity to purchase affordable health care insurance. They're looking at multi-channel access, having three sites, three different call centers. Two would be state-run call center facilities, one in Sacramento, which would be the largest, and then another one that the state runs somewhere else in the state of California. And then there would be one county call center facility within the state. Our next graphic we showed you the last time, this is kind of what they're proposing. There would be multi-channel access through phones, faxes, emails, posting, web and web chat. There would be a number of ways to get access to the call centers. Again, the Central State Call Center would have the public employees with 40 to 60% of the staff. A second physical contact center, again run by the state, would be 20 to 30% of the staff. And then a third physical contact center or call center, which would accommodate 20 to 30% of the staff. And this consortia or county intake model for ongoing management would include intake and eligibility, determining what plan people were eligible for, and then helping them enroll in that plan. We would then also be able, since we are a county social services department, to also interact with our own Medi-Cal program so that we could do a lot locally around whether people are eligible for Medi-Cal, whether they're indigent health care people that are impacting our health services agency, or whether they're open and eligible to have other health care options. So that's kind of the way it would be set up. Again, to update you, on October 30th, we came before you and you authorized us to research and analyze and go ahead and develop a comprehensive proposal in response to what the state was offering in order to operate a state-contracted health benefit exchange call center. We have participated in a number of opportunities to interact with the state and the other interested counties. We've gone to bidders conferences. We've had a lot of communication with the state through email and calls, had several conference calls to clarify issues. And as in any process like this, the more questions you have, the more answers you get, and so we've been narrowing down the proposal. The project has grown since I came to initially talk with you, and that is at the state direction. It was not our local initiative to grow the project, but at the state level, they have done better analyzing of what the need is, so the project has grown somewhat. The staffing level range now has increased to a total of up to 250 to 300 agents in order to ensure that you always have 100 people or call agents available at any time to take calls. Also, because the numbers have increased, we've estimated our space need to increase. We're now looking at approximately a 40,000 square foot need for space because of the increased number of people that would be involved. One of the things that we wanted to assure you in terms of how we're proposing to go about this is when we decided to respond to this, and you gave us permission to do that, we wanted to assure everyone in the community and in the county of what we're doing. We're moving forward with this proposal on several guiding principles. We're going to move forward based on the idea that it is potential for viable economic development within our county within the coming year and for years to come. We're also moving forward with this proposal based on the premise that there will be zero negative liability exposure to the county, legal, fiscal, or any other kind. The county will move forward based on an understanding that it is entering into a partnership with the exchange and that both parties will act accordingly. The first RFP to share with you came out more like a private bidder where they sent out an RFP as if we were a company. And all of the counties responded and said, no, that's not what we want. We want a partnership. And so they have done a great deal to change the bid at the state level. The county will also move forward employing as many county and industry best practices as possible in the areas of operations, governance, and technology. Also, the county will move forward with its proposal on the understanding that this proposal and collaboration will in no way impede what we do on a regular basis for mandated services for our regularly operated programs on an ongoing basis. Also, the county will move forward with this proposal with caution but optimism for the eventual exchange call center contract, if awarded, to be advantageous to the county, the Healthcare Exchange Board goals, and the people of Stanislaus County and the state of California. So our participation is in a sealed bid process, and that is one of the reasons that what you see here are ranges and not as many specific numbers. The county's proposal totals approximately $65 to $70 million spread over a three-year period, and that includes significant startup costs. All the costs, including startup and ongoing operations, will be 100% federally and state funded with no county general fund cost or any matching fund requirements. The proposal also includes a potential for up to 300 full-time and part-time staff. The proposal is subject to negotiation between the county and the Health Benefit Exchange Board, and the Community Services Agency will be working with the CEO's office and County Council on moving forward, if awarded, an acceptable contract that would then come back to your board for approval. The benefits that we see are mainly in the economic development area initially. We've seen additional 200 to 300 jobs in our community, which would be very exciting. And with economic development factors, we were in conversation with the Alliance WorkNet and talking about how they project other kinds of jobs that flow from any development of particular jobs. And there are always indirect and induced jobs, which brings additional positions into the county. And the approximation was about 100 additional jobs that would be brought in for those 200, 300 jobs created in the call center. Also, we see the utilization of locally leased space. The funding, again, is 100% federal and state dollars. And we also see the positive impact for health care options for the uninsured in our county. As we all know, we have a lot of uninsured people, and we have health care concerns for all of our constituents, and this would be something that would help in that arena. In terms of our next steps, the notification of intent to award is officially anticipated to be January 4th of 2013. If in between then, there may be questions going back and forth once we submit a proposal if approved, and that would happen in the next few weeks. If this county is selected to be awarded, the contract negotiations will officially begin on January 5th through the end of the month, through January 28th. Then we would come back to request approval from the board to enter into a contract with the Health Benefit Exchange on January 29th meeting in 2013. And if approved, after January 29, 2013, we would begin recruitment and startup activities on a timeline that would be part of the contract to meet contractual requirements. So what we are recommending at this time is asking for approval to finalize and submit this proposal to the State of California Healthcare Exchange Board to be able to enter into a partnership to operate the local health benefit exchange call center site in Stanislaus County. And we're open for any questions.
Questions or comments?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, please. Looking at this timeline, because it says February, right? February 1st
mm-hmm.
is the start of the contract. But what's the expectation on February 1st that we'll start negotiating for a lease, we'll move forward? Because when does it have to be operational?
It needs to be up and running by late spring, July, and then open enrollment is happening in the fall. So we would have a few months. It is an aggressive timeline, but we would have a few months in the spring to find the staff, to find the location, to do all those things.
Are you doing any pre-work on that, or
we've done a survey in the sense of just finding out what's out there and what would be required. So we've done the work of what do we have to do if we get it, but we haven't done anything official. No.
Okay. So open enrollment is this fall.
Mm-hmm.
Are there going to be, as part of the negotiations, a timeline of when we will hire people
mm-hmm.
and then we get that contract?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Supervisor Montique?
Yes. Are there any provisions for overrun costs? That is, we're given an estimate
mm-hmm.
cost, and by that I mean overruns not only for putting it together, but if all of a sudden there are increased costs in running the process and managing the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was considered, and I'll turn it over to Patrice to see.
Because everything ends up in an overrun.
Yes.
I don't care what it is. So I was hoping we'd have a provision there of some sort to indicate that, but
mm-hmm.
then that still ends up being controlled by the state if they want to address it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Are they the ones that determine the salaries? Are they the ones that determine what equipment's to be purchased, or how is that taken care of?
So based on the instructions that came in the request for offer process, we've submitted our bid utilizing existing county staff classifications, similar to the series that's used in the customer service center that's already operated in Stanworks. And in projecting costs going forward, recognizing the need to mitigate any county exposure, we have budgeted conservatively, consistent with the way that we would put together any of our budget processes. Our proposal identifies that we would have a need to negotiate those rates should there be any board-approved changes to MOUs going into the future or unanticipated costs. But we have built into our rates what we think are good estimates going forward of cost increases that could arise.
Okay, well then, they determine the type or the number of pieces of equipment. I assume that would be in the proposal?
Yes.
Do they have full control as to what equipment in case they want to add on to something later?
Mm-hmm.
Is there an ongoing process, I guess mm-hmm. I'm asking, to cover costs if their requirements become greater?
Yes, within the proposal, they are proposing that the state would cover all the costs of equipment and furniture.
Okay, from here on.
Yes.
Thank you.
Trish, can you address as far as the reimbursement? because essentially there's probably going to be some money that gets put out front. So that might also help Supervisor Monti to understand the timing.
Yes, the recently issued Addendum 2 did provide a little more clarification that just came last Thursday. And within that Addendum 2, they identified some more specifics about the billing. They have identified also that it is not their desire to provide advance funds. Prior to that, that would, of course, been my pitch. There will be some cash flow timing, and the actual, I think, payment process would be part of what we would be interested in negotiating with them.
Perfect. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Okay.
Supervisor Withrow?
Just a couple things. This still scares me, this thing, that we're going to be on the hook for something here. And I know we talk about a couple different things in here. We talk about, and this is Jack, I guess you'll have to work hard to make sure that we're protected here so that this thing does crash and burn and we don't end up on the hook. You know, I wonder, we have 200 or 300 employees working here. This thing goes for a few years, and then we're contributing to the retirement plan. Of course, it's all reimbursed. And then say it ends. And then we still have these employees, which maybe no longer work or they get relocated. But we still have the cost of that retirement plan that we'll have to continue to fund until these people retire. So as the stock market goes down, which a defined benefit plan works, we end up with still having cost here that we're going to have to cover for these employees if this thing ended, that the state wouldn't be around anymore to cover those costs. Say that, you know, the stock market took a nosedive, and now that we've got an unfunded liability here, we're going to have to cover this. I mean, so there's a potential there if this thing were to end, we could be on the hook for a lot of money down the road. So, I mean, and the state would be nowhere to be found, you know, to help us cover that. So that is a concern, one of my concerns about this. The space, we're going to find space. Do we have space? Is there space that we own right now that we could use? Like Vita was talking about, when are we going to start looking for the space? I would hope that we would start with our own assets, and if anything, we would use some of our existing assets towards this, which would make it more of a possibility, I guess, than if that were to happen. The other thing that here at the end we talked about here, you know, it says the funding is initially 100% federal and state dollars, and then it shifts to private pay once the Health Benefit Exchange call center site is fully operational in 2014. I'm not sure I understand it. It is the department's understanding that the sustainability is built into the model through premium payments covering call center costs ongoing. So after 2014, what's going to happen there? So then it becomes...
It's our understanding that at that point, the people who are buying health insurance, part of the cost of their insurance funds those call centers. So it would be probably some sort of phase-in or out approach of the state support. Then as the revenue builds up from the actual insurance that is sold, that would start to support the call centers.
Okay, so we're just not certain of that, but it's just...
That's the plan.
It's our hope. So what if it didn't?
That is where we are relying on our county council to build in a lot of very good, tight clauses within any contract that would be awarded.
So that we could turn around and walk out of this thing at that point. If it failed. Jack, you okay with that?
Yes. One of the central issues that we're focused on is what we're referring to as the ramp down provisions. It's very difficult to establish a program of this size and magnitude and turn it off the next day. So there needs to be a period of transition, and we're working closely with CSA staff and with others in my office to address those particular issues.
Okay, we just have a long history of ending up being stuck with the bill here from the state. So, you know, I'm not a big fan of the Obamacare as it is anyway, but if we can bring jobs back to our area, bring some of our tax dollars that we're paying out and get them back coming here, that's fine, as long as at the end of the day that we're not stuck with this.
Well, and we've been very sensitive to that in many respects because this is not work that we would normally do. So we want to be very careful about what we're agreeing to, knowing that there's a lot of positive benefit, but also knowing that there are risks.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be terrible if we end up having to take away from other programs as a result of us getting into this thing. So I just encourage us to tread very carefully and make sure we're safe. So, okay.
Any other questions or comments? We'll ask the public if they wish to comment on this item. I do have one specific request to speak. Kenny Kenoyer. Good morning.
Good morning, Chairman O'Brien and members of the board. I pulled this item off of the and read the agenda summary, and I didn't know that we were going to get this excellent discussion. I'm really in favor of this. I realize that a lot of people don't like Obamacare, and you know, it's there. We need to implement it. A county is going to get this, no matter where it is in California. I think that it is so important for us to realize that this is a possibility of 300 jobs coming here. It is, you know, we are in desperate need of that kind of employment. And also, I think it would encourage them having more technical people moving here or living here or using people here who maybe have graduated from college, can't find a job, and this will be perfect for them. And finally, I mean, I won't go on this because they did answer all the questions I had, but I want the board to remember that they were elected to serve the people of the county and not to impose their personal disagreements with the federally funded mandate programs. Thank you.
Very good. Any other public comment on this item? Bring it back to the board. And I'd just like to commend staff for going after something that they didn't have to, that they weren't mandated to do. So thank you for that. And if we're awarded this, then we'll put a lot of backing to our county council to make an ironclad contract to resolve all of our concerns. But bringing those jobs to this county, I think, would be great. And so I just want to thank staff for going after this. Other questions, comments?
I want to make one more comment because in the retirement system, the vesting isn't till year five. This contract right now is 3.4, so we're not sure if it's even going to reach that. That's just something to look forward to, but I still agree. I commend staff going forward on this. We just have to be real vigilant. And Ms. Kenoyer, you're right. We need the jobs, but we also need to keep the county afloat. So we're doing a balancing act up here. I'm not so sure it's personal. Our personal preferences, I think it's just that we have to protect the county. So, anyways, with that, I'll make a motion to approve.
Motion, is there a second?
Second.
Motion and second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Item passes 5-0. Brings us to correspondence.
This one has received a letter from the Memorial Medical Center, a Sutter Health affiliate, regarding the layoff of 114 employees to commence on or about January 15, 2013 at their 1700 Coffee Road Modesto facility pursuant to the WARN Act requirements.
Refer to the Stanislaus Economic Development and Workforce Alliance and the Alliance WorkNet.
This board has received a copy of the California State Association of Counties Excess Insurance Authority 2012 Annual Report.
Refer to Chief Executive Office, Risk Management Division.
This board has received a letter from the Hostess Brands regarding their bankruptcy proceedings, the potential closure of their plants, and the laying off of employees.
Refer to Stanislaus Economic Development and Workforce Alliance and the Alliance WorkNet.
This board has received a copy of the draft program environmental impact report for the San Joaquin Rail Corridor 2035 Vision Project.
Refer to Department of Public Works.
This board has received from the California Department of Fish and Game a notice of preparation of a draft environmental impact report for the San Joaquin River Restoration Program, Salmon Conservation and Research Facility, and related management action projects.
Refer to the Department of Public Works, the Department of Environmental Resources, the Department of Planning and Community Development, and the Agricultural Commissioner and Sealers of Weights and Measures.
This board has received a notice of receipt of petition from the California Fish and Game Commission regarding the listing of the Townsend's big-eared bat as threatened or endangered under the California Endangered Species Act.
Refer to the Fish and Wildlife Committee.
This board has received the claims as noted on the agenda.
We acknowledge receipt of claims and refer to Chief Executive Office, Risk Management Division. Are there any Board of Supervisor reports?
Seeing none, is there a legislative fiscal management report?
Not today, Chair.
Okay, we do have closed session. County Council, you announce closed session?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we have conference with legal counsel to discuss existing litigation pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9 Subdivision A involving four cases. First is Leslie Cook versus Stanislaus County Superior Court, case number 660775. Second is People of the State of California versus Dan Avila, Stanislaus County Superior Court, case number 679843. Third is Maria Alvarez et al. Versus County of Stanislaus, Stanislaus County Superior Court, case number 612601. And fourth is Forensic Consultants Medical Group versus Stanislaus County Superior Court, case number 626798. Additionally, there is a conference with legal counsel to discuss significant exposure to litigation pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9 Subdivision B involving two matters. One related to the claim filed by Arena Engert on August 24, 2012. Second, related to the claim filed by the City of Turlock concerning calculation of the property tax administration fee. We do not expect to report out on any of these matters.
This meeting is adjourned to closed session.